You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On this special edition of the show, we are of course focusing on today's events in Brussels, where over 30 people have died and dozens been injured after bomb blasts at the city's main airport and at a metro station. I'll discuss with my guests Jane Kinnemont, Roger Boys and Steve Bloomfield how well European security services have worked together, as the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi says that today's attacks underline the need for the European Union to develop a common defence and security strategy. We'll also ask what has led to Brussels becoming a centre for European extremism and if European airports need to rethink their security precautions. Plus, we'll speak to Monocle's correspondent in Brussels, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson, who was at the airport during the attacks for the latest. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnemont, who's Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Roger Boys, Diplomatic Editor of The Times here in London. And also joining me in the studio today is Monocle's Executive Editor, Steve Bloomfield. Welcome to the programme. Belgium is today in lockdown after more than 30 people were killed in suspected suicide attacks on Brussels airport and the city's metro system. The attacks come 4 days after Salah Abdeslam, the main fugitive in the Paris attacks, was seized in Brussels. Belgium has now raised its terror threat to its highest level. Jane, we'll begin with you. It's been an extraordinary period for Belgium, in the news for all the wrong reasons for many months now. Even its Prime Minister Charles Michel has become somebody we're used to seeing on our TV. So many announcements coming out of Belgium. What do you think it is that has made Belgium such a centre for extremism, it seems, such a centre for Islamic State?
One of the paradoxical things about Islamic State is that it speaks this global language of jihad, but the recruitment dynamics are often very local. And when you look at studies of countries which have had a lot of recruitment, often of foreign fighters going to Iraq and Syria, it tends to happen at an extremely local level. So in Belgium, we have this area of Molenbeek, which has really been a hotbed for radical recruitment. Not necessarily just because people are going on the internet and reaching out to ISIS that way, but because of very, very local networks that are able to hybridise the sense of global injustice with people's perceptions that they are facing entrenched discrimination in their own society. And what some of the mothers of foreign fighters have spoken about is this sense of there being structural racism, a state that isn't interested in the welfare of often unemployed young men. Typically, these would also be very likely recruits for gangs. But the fusion with ISIS has meant that this kind of disaffected minority has been able to have a sadly very, very lethal impact.
Roger, the causes of extremism seem so complicated. Jane, you points to some more traditional kind of triggers there. But interestingly, when we see some of the attackers in previous incidents, they come from quite middle-class backgrounds. They aren't unemployed. They've had kind of easier upbringings. And in Belgium, it feels like there's something else is going on. We know that it's a divided society, linguistically, culturally. We know that the security services have had some problems kind of speaking to each other just over language issues, the way that the institutions are set up. We've had a country without government for many, many months. Do you feel there's, certainly in no failed state, but do you feel that there is something about Belgium which means that it's easier for the jihadis to hide there?
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, there are structural problems with Belgium that do allow... I mean, what I'm worried about is that Molenbeek has actually, in effect, become a kind of safe haven for ISIS sympathizers, and that would be frightening. And if that were the case, you have to ask, well, why did that come about? And it's to do partly with... it's not a failed state, but it is a fractured state. And it has absolutely more than a dozen different police institutions, for example, that clash with each other and don't. We've been aware of this since last November, since the attacks in Paris, when when Belgium, in effect, became a fallback area for the attackers in Paris. It's clear that there is that to actually get a grip on these on this kind of phenomenon, you need a more of a centralized state, which Belgium defiantly does not, definitely and defiantly does not. And what we're seeing, quite interestingly, and I just noticed it really over the last couple of months, is that France is kind of quietly running Belgium as a kind of security colony. More and more French intelligence officers are advising and steering Belgium in the right direction. Of course, that's because there's a joint investigation into the Paris attacks, but also because France feels the confidence that comes with a centralized security machine that they have and that Belgium doesn't have. And that's, I think, why we're seeing this. I wouldn't say it's a lawless area, a lawless district, but it's a very unmonitored and unsupervised area. Even the internet cafes there are not properly watched. Can you believe that? That's just unbelievable.
I want to bring Steve in 1 second, but we have on the line Charlotte McDonald Gibson. Normally on Maduro House, we don't have guests, but we wanted to speak to her today. She's our Brussels correspondent, and she was in the airport when the attack happened. Charlotte, thank you for coming on the programme. We're talking to our guest today about two possible causes for these attacks, in a way. A security failure, but also a failure of the state of Belgium. I know it's very early on in the aftermath to begin to kind of really understand exactly what's happened. But do you feel that those are the two causes that the Belgian press will be covering tomorrow? Still a feeling that the Belgian, you know, authorities cannot get to grips with the situation, but that there is something a bit more complicated going on in Brussels that's allowed the jihadis to be hidden amongst many other people in that city?
I think that's certainly the angle that a lot of the international press will be looking at. I think that sort of soul-searching, it doesn't come in quite that same tone sometimes in the Belgian press, because you've been discussing the linguistic divide in Belgium, and the media is on those same divides. You have the Flemish language media and you have the French language media, and you don't have a really a national Belgian media. So all those issues of the split of the country, the divide, which have played into the intelligence, the lack of intelligence sharing, those also play out in the media. So it'll be interesting to see, certainly, how in-depth they go into these sort of issues. But certainly it's something that the international media have really honed in on ever since the Paris attacks and when we found out that a lot of the attacks had been planned here in Brussels.
And what are you hearing in Brussels tonight? We've got images which have seemed to have been released slightly by accident by the police, which show three of the people who they feel may have been involved in the attacks. Two of the gentlemen are wearing a black glove on one hand, which is said to maybe hide the trigger for suicide belts. And the other person is meant to be potentially back in the city or on the run. What do we know about that tonight?
Well, I don't know much more than what we can see at the moment. I've been at the airport all day, so I've been very focused on the eyewitness accounts there, and I've been doing that for most of the day. So I haven't been completely across exactly what's happening in the news. But yes, I've just seen these images as well. And what strikes me is that we had this manhunt in Brussels. It came after the Paris attacks, and for months they were on the lookout for Abdullah Salem, my main Paris attacker. And finally, he was caught 4 days ago. And now what do we have again in Brussels? Another manhunt, another suspect on the loose. So I think certainly for residents here, it's going to be this awful sense of deja vu and the sense of, well, is this ever going to end? Are they ever really going to be able to get a handle on this?
Well, we're going to let you go, Charlotte. Thank you very much for joining us, and we're all pleased that you got out of the airport safely. Steve, just listening to that conversation, it's going to be very difficult in the coming days. This terror, in a way, works because people don't know what's going to happen. There's a fear that something else is around the corner. And as Charlotte said, that's, in a way, what they've achieved. You know, Brussels is back on tenterhooks, nervous about who's in the city and what could happen next.
The big danger here is something that hasn't really happened with the other terror attacks we've seen in Europe, which is that if there is a connection between this attack and the attack in Paris, and the Belgian prosecutor has so far said, well, it's too early to know for sure, but certain people think it might well be. This suggests that that they have the capability to strike more than once. Now, we look at what happened in London on the 7th of July in 2005. There was a copycat follow-up 2 weeks later by another group, which failed abysmally. And what that then meant was that we were able as Londoners to get back to our normal lives. You know, the day after 7/7, everyone got back on the tube, and it was a lot easier to be able to do that because there was one attack. The same in Madrid after the train bombings then. You know, people were able to get straight back on the trains, and that made things a lot easier. The moment that you start to think, firstly, these guys are still out there and they could attack again, and secondly, you're not convinced that your own authorities have the capability to counter this sort of attack, that's then when this fear comes in that terrorism does so well that people start to think, I'm worried about what might happen next.
Jane, you wanted to dive in on this terror point.
Yeah, just to add that, you know, London and Madrid, of course, are both cities that had suffered numerous terrorist attacks beforehand from the IRA in the case of the UK and from ETA in the case of Spain. So I think that also added to the sense of the population that the city has been through this before and survived, and it can withstand this as well. For Belgium, I think the whole thing has been much more of a shock, and clearly the security services just were not prepared, were not set up to deal with this kind of phenomenon.
Roger, when we talk about those security services, we're talking about a Europe where migration, not just the refugee migration, people move around, it's very hard to track people. It's much, we saw that, the Paris attacker had managed to hide himself away in a community right in the heart of Brussels and had not been traceable. They could not get hold of him. It's very easy for people to disappear. Are we being kind of naive to think that the security services can control this situation anymore?
Well, we've gone through different steps to try and prevent this happening. I mean, we're bringing in biometric passports, and we go through all these. We're probably at some stage going to get proper iris recognition everywhere to stop this quick interchange of passports and using the Schengen zone in this way. But the truth is, the Schengen information system, which is supposed to exchange information, is not functioning properly. It's useful, but it's not useful enough because a lot of people don't want to offer information because they don't want to compromise their sources. So we share information, we share intelligence information, but in a selective amount. So there's a lot of pressure now to change that and to be much more comprehensive. And there's a lot of pressure on England because we're part of this Five Eyes system of intelligence sharing with America and what we might call the Anglosphere. In which we pick up an awful lot of traffic and communication between groups. And some of it is shared via Britain, but not a lot of it. So Germany, for example, who's as worried as anybody by all of this, because Cologne is, if you're going to shift from Paris to Brussels, the next smart thing to do is to move from Brussels to Cologne. It's all within this geographical range, and it's very easy to disappear in Cologne. So the Germans in particular are making demands that there should be greater intelligence sharing of this rather privileged information, from this rather privileged information relationship that we have with America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand.
Steve, actually, we'll bring you in here. When you hear about that, this idea of like tracking people and what's going on, there's two background stories here which are going to play into this in the coming days. One is actually a discussion about how European institutions work together. Matteo Renzi saying, we need to do more. We're at the very point where European institutions are at each other's throats. We don't see that kind of negotiation. Do you think that's possible on the security side? And it does play, whether we like it or not, into the migration story. We have a million people crossing Europe who have come, many of them undocumented, are trying to prove who they are now that they want to claim refugee status. And let's be honest, it's a tiny, tiny minority who are sneaking in with them potentially. But those both narratives are going to play out in kind of complicated ways, don't you think?
I think the bigger problem for European governments to get to grips with is the radicalisation within their own communities, which is what we've seen here. I thought was Jane's point earlier about gangs, about how a lot of these sorts of factors that play into how someone becomes radicalised in the first place is very similar to how people get into gangs in the first place. And actually, we've seen some of the radicalisation has begun with people joining gangs. Mm. They've become disconnected from their society, and then they've been radicalised on top of that. So I think that's one key thing to look at. And the other is that, you know, as much as we're criticising European institutions, the fact that they were able to catch Salah Abdeslam over the weekend suggests that they are able, the Belgians with French help, are able to do some things. The fact also that, you know, and it's difficult to say on a day when more than 30 people have been killed, but on the whole, there haven't been that many attacks over the past 15 years in Europe when you consider the possibilities that there could have been. You talk to British intelligence experts and they'll tell you that 6 or 7 big attacks have been prevented in the UK in the last 12 months. And I imagine there are similar figures for attacks elsewhere in Europe.
Jane, when you work on a program looking at the Middle East and North Africa, we see the whole region disrupted by civil war, by internal collapse, by poverty, by the forms of radicalization that are just happening there. Then, if these people come to Europe, and as you say, one of the causes of radicalization is then that people don't feel integrated into society. We're talking about many people coming without trades or skills or language ability. They're going to sit in capital cities hoping for integration, hoping to change their lives. But their kids and things are going to sit outside the system for a very long time. Do you think that there is a kind of a bigger issue here that we talk about, a high-speed integration of people who are going to settle in capital cities around Europe?
Well, this is a huge question about Europe's future, how it manages integration and the diversity of cultures in the future. I think it's worth emphasising that the vast majority of diaspora communities that are of Middle Eastern family origin but based in Europe are, contributors to the economy. They are not security risks. They are indeed, in countries like the UK or France, they're often at the front line of providing intelligence to the security forces on terrorist threats that come from within their own communities. But of course, they will feel that they are going to be blamed and scapegoated for the actions of a very small minority within them.
Although we did see, this fracturing, we were talking about this earlier today, that you did see in Molenbeek last week when they arrested the suspect, that there were people on the streets demonstrating against the police, saying, get out of our neighbourhood. Mm. The fracture is there so deep. Yeah, of course, many people were probably glad that he was caught. But there are many people who don't sympathise with the cause in a way, right, but are so kind of alienated from Belgian society that they would protest almost in support of him. Is the problem a little bit bigger than we kind of are willing sometimes to admit?
Yeah, and I think going back to this issue of why some areas become real hotbeds for radical militant groups, then you often get that kind of poisonous and toxic relationship with local law enforcement, and a sense that the police are enemies, a sense that gets shared by people who, as you say, might not be active radicals themselves, but fail to prevent things or fail to stop others from their community joining.
Roger, I know you wanted to come back at some of the points that Jane was raising there to add some other kind of nuances to that as well.
Yes. When you're trying to work out a state response to this problem, it's you have to look at really every ligament of what's going on in this integration process. So if you've got a kid who is not integrating well, and he falls in, as Jane was suggesting, into car theft, then a certain kind of policeman registers that. He gets nicked and doesn't communicate that this boy is in any way vulnerable. He gets nicked. He gets radicalized then perhaps in prison. In the old days, he would perhaps have become a hardcore criminal. Nowadays, he maybe gets radicalized. He comes out of prison. His parents see that he's going to a mosque, and they're very pleased because he's gone on the straight path. Now he's given up stealing cars, and he's now in the hands of the local imam, and that's good. So suddenly the family becomes supportive of a person who's on a radical path. Meanwhile, the local police, who would normally have kept an eye on him, don't keep an eye on him anymore because he's not stealing cars anymore. So, and suddenly he disappears. He disappears from view. So there are all these elements, the prison bit, school, parents, the mosque, all this a counter-radicalization strategy has to really take in all of that. And Belgium doesn't have the capacity for that. It doesn't have the bureaucratic capacity, and it really hasn't got the nous. And what I was saying before, France is actually trying to nudge them into this direction. And it was actually very instrumental in that arrest last week. Now, you're going to ask me something else, sorry.
No. Steve's trying to dive in now.
Let me just come on that point from Roger, because I think what's interesting then is to combat that, you need two quite important things. One, you need police force and security services that have the resources and the capabilities to deal with those issues that you've just
and
raised.
And communicate
there.
With each other.
Yes, yeah. and that speak to each other. But then you also need something else, which is a bit harder to define, which is a more general sense of national pride within a community, a connection to a nation state, which I think that, you know, for all the issues there may have been in the UK, on the whole, the vast majority of Muslims have a connection to Britain. They feel British. And I get the impression that that isn't quite the same across Belgium, which I think then makes it a lot harder to get those connections between people within a community who feel willing to go to the police and security services themselves about people that they're concerned about.
Well, and partly in the UK, many of these Muslim families have been here for generations. These aren't, you know, people who have just arrived from the Middle East. These are people who've been here for generations, and they provide a network in a community when new people do arrive that they can explain the sense of community. But the only complicated thing here, Roger, is I worry that it kind of sets up a situation where, in a way, you need to and you should be policing young Muslim boys in a slightly different way to other people. You need to say, okay, he's going to jail for, you know, stealing a car. We need to keep an eye on what happens to him in prison. If he begins to become, part of a community of people, we feel are radicalizing them. But as soon as you do that, quite rightfully, many people in the Muslim community are going to say, hold on, why are we being picked out? Why are our kids being focused on at school? Our son is no worse than anybody else. It becomes a little bit racialized as well as about religiosity, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so. I think it's about identifying vulnerable people. And I think a properly run prison system should be able to do that. I think that's quite straightforward. The problem about allegiance that Stephen mentions is really to do with a strong central state. If you don't have a strong central state to identify with, then you're not going to integrate with it. And that's what's happening. I mean, they could create their own little, self-governing republic there, just one metro stop away from Schuman. That's how much freedom they have. They live almost outside the state, apart from collecting welfare benefits.
Jane, you know many of these organizations, you know how they function. When you look at something like Al Qaeda or Islamic State or many of these other organizations that have been operating in Europe, do we have more to fear from, me and Steve were talking about earlier, the difference between a terrorist in the past, they wanted to escape and get away. Here we see people with pictures, within minutes, because in the end they are out for, they know that they will die probably. They know that they are happy to blow themselves up. It's a different kind of terrorism that's much harder to police as well, isn't it?
Yes, and, typically driven by people who are very, very young. And that's something that ISIS has been able to institutionalise more effectively than Al-Qaeda. There's a huge, interesting but unanswered question about why ISIS has been so good at recruiting people from Europe. Al-Qaeda would have loved to carry out these types of attack, but had much less capacity to do it. But it seems to be in part because it offers this appeal to very young people. Some of the key leaders are in their 30s. Many of the recruits are teenagers or, people of 20 years old, seeking to have some kind of exciting impact on the world as they would see it.
We haven't got much time left. Steve, following the Paris attacks, we felt that, something had changed, that we were more primed for what would happen in our cities.
But again, we look at, you know, airport security. It just can't all be locked down in this way. What's your thoughts on how we live with this?
We have to live with it. There are some things we just can't stop. If someone has the resources and the determination and the, you know, the absolute will to do this, they can't be stopped at the gates of an airport. They can't be stopped at the gates of a subway, metro, or tube station. It's impossible. For example, you know, these guys didn't go through security at the airport. It happened at the departure gates. If you move the security to the very front of the airport and everyone has to go in lines there and have their bags checked before they get into the airport, well, then that becomes, you know, the place where they will do it. So to a certain extent, we have to live with the fact that this might just happen. The important thing is then what happens behind the scenes. And as ever, as we've been discussing for the last 15 years, what is the balance that you create between security and freedom? And it's a balance that across the world we're still working out.
We're just going to quickly bring in Danny Giacopelli, who, of course, is a Monocle correspondent. We sent him today to Brussels. I believe he's just arrived in the city. Danny, good to speak to you. Tell us, I know it was very complicated. You couldn't go by plane, you couldn't go by train. You've gone via the Netherlands. How difficult was it gaining access to the city? Or does the city feel as though it's functioning again this evening?
Andrew, yeah, so we hopped on the first flight to Rotterdam. And we were actually on the flight. The entire flight was actually probably journalists, to be honest. It was BBC guys from a couple of national newspapers. We literally just arrived in Brussels right now, moments ago. It's pretty deserted, actually. You know, I'm not a regular traveler here, but there's not a lot of people around. I noticed an army car on the way in. We drove from Rotterdam to Brussels. There was a car with a couple guys with submachine guns. You know, there weren't border checks, though. I heard reports that there would be checks on the border, that they would institute it. We flew right by from Holland to Belgium. But it's pretty quiet right now.
Well, Danny, we're going to be cutting to on this evening's show. So it's great to have you there in the city. And we look forward to your reports over the next day or so. Yes, we'll hear you on the daily tonight. We come back to the studio just for final comments. Roger, final thoughts on how we stop this being the new normal?
As Steve said, we're going to somehow have to resolve the problem of security versus freedom, but also security versus mobility. And it might be that we become a much more immobile society, as your reporter has just found out. It may be that since travel hubs are the most vulnerable and the most open, and also the ones that are the chosen targets because they disrupt society so overwhelmingly, that we find some other ways of arranging our lives.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. It would be nice to come back for one more round of comments from everyone. But my thanks to Jane Kinnamont, Roger Boys and Steve Bloomfield for joining me here in for the special edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Young. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Up next, it's The Atlantic Shift. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 and 100 hours. From me, Andrew Chuck, goodbye.